I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. I'll keep you in suspense, the man said. Narcissistic to the end of a campaign about himself. Now it is the sovereign voters who will keep Donald Trump in suspense, Hillary Clinton too, as we, the people, decide. But what is it really that we're coming to the end of? A riveting, dangerous, damaging roller coaster ride to a view of the abyss, you could say, or an entertaining year off, a Seinfeld campaign about nothing, as he used to say. Up to the last debate where climate change, our survival issue, didn't make the cut of what had to be talked about. Strange thing in a contest of personal negatives, real heat did surface anyway around Black Lives, patriarchy, our nearly 40-year Middle East war, almost despite the distraction of those candidates. This hour, a tentative summing up of 2016 with a variety of humble witnesses. Nico Mealy gets us started, one of the tech geniuses inside the Howard Dean campaign of 2004 and in the Huffington Post back office, a poet and a writer too, author of The End of Big, and now director of Harvard's Shorenstein Center around media and politics. Short form, Nico, on 2016.
It's the collapse of the middle. The collapse of the middle class, the collapse of the middle of the country, and the collapse of the political middle. That's the short form of 2016. That's what we've seen.
Do you have a sense of how it ends?
I think it ends with a return to our local communities, ultimately. I don't know how fast we're going to get there. The next 24 months will be brutal. But a number of trends are forcing us to look at our neighbors again. And that's the hopeful part of the story.
That's the redeeming feature. What brought it down? And why so much anger and still so much sort of stability at the core? Status quo stability, maybe not all good.
I mean, in many ways, there are vast swaths of the country where things aren't that good. You know, if you were born after 1980 in the United States, you will never make as much money as your parents. You will never own a house as large or as valuable as their home. You will pay more for your education, end up in debt, and it will be less valuable. You'll probably pay more for your health care, and it will be not as good. I mean, in a variety of measures, there's actual real challenges for the country.
We got spun around again this week, Nico, I got to tell you. Morning after the third presidential debate by your colleague, Ron Suskind. He's a one-of-a-kind reporter, a confidant of presidents, two Bushes, one Clinton so far, one Obama. He's a group psychologist, self-taught, I think, but a teacher of how classic American narratives work. As usual with us, he was running hard against the power of PAC journalism.
I felt it was actually a very strong night for Trump. And the last thing he did was, of course, the threat he has been holding in his hands and seasoning for months. He says, "Don't be misled. I am in no way giving up this club I have. This club I have to say I'm not buying the result of the election." I mean, he's been saying that in a whole host of ways, really, for months and months, in some ways for a whole year, when he talked about not supporting the Republican nominee if he's not it. So, you know, I felt that it was actually a night where, looking at the optics, looking at not what's said, but how it's said, because that's really where these debates are won. You know, Reagan got that. People don't remember the exact verbiage. They remember attitude, suggestion. He was on his game last night. And he kind of said at the end, "Four more years of Barack Obama is what you get with her."
You think he won the debate? I was struck. Hugh Hewitt said he won 14 out of 15 points and then blew it on the last one. Deal with that notion that it's just an impossibly anti-democratic, anti-American notion that I will decide when this thing is over and how it ends.
I think he did win most of the exchanges. And I think the view that he handed it over at the end is precisely the kind of views the establishment has had for 1 year solid about Donald Trump, missing it, not understanding how people from the wide middle, predominantly of the country, see him as bloodying the nose of the establishment. Those smug coastals, that's what Trump will do for me. because I'm left behind in this nation. It's many nations, certainly two nations at very least, and I'm in the left behind country. I'm in a fight with some guy from Jakarta who will never have health insurance ever in his life. That's what I'm competing with in my small town in America where the factory's about to leave. Trump's my guy.
It makes my head spin how fast this thing changes. A week ago, after the Billy Bush tapes, we thought, no, it's about men and women. We could also say it was the 99 against the one, or the commentariat against the peasants. I'm wondering if the coastal privilege against the sinking middle can turn votes at the end here.
Back at the Wall Street Journal in the old days and at the New York Times, we had sort of a chestnut of discussion, race, class, or gender.
Exactly.
Of the three fault line issues in America and in many societies. And we would argue it. Race, of course, race, original sin in America. Well, class, I mean, we say we're a classless society, but we're anything but, and ever more so now with the divisions that are profound. Gender, it's everywhere. Well, the fact is they all mix together. And what we're dealing with now is a kind of shifting back and forth between race, class, and gender in terms of narrative. We're going to get some switching around probably still before the finish. But ultimately, what you're seeing is that even though it gets pushed back, like the gender debate did with Trump's, you know, the allegations against Trump, I think that class is bubbling up again and again, this divided country. In some ways, it's divided between the coastals and the inlanders as it was between the North and South before the Civil War. These are two nations. And Trump is a denizen of the golden towers of the coastlines who is moving into the wide middle of the valley and saying, I'm your guy. And only I can lead the army back to take the coast.
How in the world, I asked Brian Susskind, does Donald Trump escape the shame of his own gross, abusive words on the Billy Bush tape?
Clinton said it best at a White House dinner we were at in 1998 in the heat of the Lewinsky scandal, and he talked about his bond holding. He said, here's the thing I'll tell you. You see, people don't love me in spite of my flaws. They love me because of them, which is why my bond will hold. Trust me. Trump actually moved in a different direction. He said 3/4 of the country hasn't had a raise in 40 years. They are p***ed. And he moved in that direction with all of his craziness. And the more he said things that were utterly off the grid, never before heard, improvisational, where he's, you don't know what he's going to say. He's occurring on television. More people came to him. You couldn't take your eyes off him. It was like watching the skid of a car as it approached the telephone pole. He played it brilliantly, wiping out that Republican field, and he has devoured the global news cycles for 1 year. Do you know how difficult that is to do? And he's kept it going right up to last night with the surprise. No, I'll figure it out when the time comes. Okay, if you said anything other than that, what would we be doing today? We would be sitting here saying, business as usual, Hillary's got the numbers. He offered his last surprise. He's got 20 days now to work that, to work the threat. But that's an extraordinary outcome.
That's just a taste of Ron Susskind's view that this race is not over. Nico Mealy of the Shorenstein Center at Harvard. What's your take on the long narrative here?
Well, you know, Ron is right that Trump has a very compelling narrative about what's happening in the country. The only big difference is that it's like a narrow cast narrative. It's not a narrative for the general public. It's a narrative for a very small slice of the public. And that's the big change.
Could be 40%. I mean, that's something.
Well, at this point, less than 5% of the electorate has voted for Trump. And in many ways, that's who he's speaking to. I think really what we're seeing in this election is a collapse of public narrative. There is still public good. There is still the public service. But there's not a public in the media sense. Everyone is living in their little narrow media worlds. And there's not actually like a giant dueling narratives. You know, for decades, For decades, the political establishment kind of duked it out with the media establishment to deliver a narrative for the presidential race to the American people. And then the American people judged that narrative. But that's that world has evaporated. I mean, in 1980, you basically had a half hour of TV a night that every American household tuned into, and that was where the battle for the narrative happened. But now our media lives are so diffuse, are so consumptive, are across the map, and I even think we're seeing the collapse of any kind of linear narrative. Trump is a post-narrative candidate. He communicates in tweets that have no beginning, middle, or end. They're not part of a larger story. They're these little bombs he drops. You know, in the 80s, during prime time, if you turned into American television, you'd watch a sitcom, and the sitcom had a protagonist and an antagonist and a conflict that built to a giant moment and then a resolution. And today we have reality television without that kind of linear narrative structure. And we don't have it in our politics anymore either.
But Ron Suskind Line, also Harley Hochschild's in Louisiana, is that he's speaking symbolically all the time. He has a redemptive presence, almost, you know, in Louisiana among nice people, almost a martyr's standing there. That's another whole conversation. Let me just ask this about your line that the end of big. Isn't it the end of a certain New York-based elite journalistic laying down of the line?
Well, there is a kind of paradox here, right? That on the one hand, Americans, this is the most diffuse presidential election in terms of Americans' media consumption habits that we have ever lived through. Mm-hmm. That this is the first time in almost in American history that so many Americans, so few Americans have shared a single media source around the election. And yet, we had one of the largest audiences ever for the debate.
It's partly, yes, that it's diffused. It's also partly that the great establishment institutions have been so wrong about the direction of things. We've got to talk about that, too. Coming up, Sarah Smarsh joins us from the heart of Kansas, and the thundering prophet from Rolling Stone, Matt Taibbi, on where the war on Wall Street has actually taken us. This is Open Source. What will we remember about this shocking year of 2016? First, who won the White House, but what we learned and unlearned about our country. Sarah Smarsh wrote a striking piece in The Guardian last week about her very red home state of Kansas, looking Trumpish this year, but otherwise misreported and misunderstood, she says. Sarah Smarsh joins us tonight from Austin, Texas. Sarah, the stereotype you're fighting is of a sort of nosediving white underclass in a riot of class despair. What is your version of Kansas today? Maybe starting with your grandmother.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I would point first to the way that Kansas turned out in the primaries earlier this year. Kansas is a caucus state, and Bernie Sanders won pretty handily on the Democratic side. Trump didn't win on the right. But if we now contrast those two votes, which sort of represent respective ends of this emergence of populism this year on the political continuum, Bernie Sanders actually had more Kansans show up to caucus for him than Donald Trump. So, you know, that story didn't make it into national news that I saw. This narrative, though, associating Donald Trump with red states like Kansas or rural areas or the white working class prevails in spite of some numbers that would dismantle that. My grandmother, who you mentioned, she voted for the first time in her whole life. She's 71 years old, and she was among the Sanders supporters. And she'll be voting for Hillary next month proudly and also with some qualms. But she wouldn't touch Donald Trump with a 10-foot pole, and nor would many members of my family and many members of the white working class who've been kind of rendered invisible by this sort of pinning Trump on that population as a supposed base.
So what part of Kansas is trending toward Trump? And they are.
Well, so I would say among, I can only speculate because I'm not walking in a Trump voter's shoes. But what I can tell you about Kansas politics, and this might resonate for a lot of states that have a strong agricultural or rural backbone. I was raised with a kind of mix of conservative and liberal views, certainly socially liberal, sometimes skewing toward the fiscally conservative, just speaking to my upbringing in kind of Reagan era mm-hmm. Kansas. But what runs deep in Kansas, much deeper than the red color you see on a national map, is a real progressive tradition and a real kind of firebrand independent streak. So of all the messages that I took in growing up, absolutely none of them had anything to do with some sort of allegiance to a party. And actually, I still identify as an independent. I'm a registered Democrat in order to cast my vote. But I feel like I kind of inherited a healthy distrust of government for a country that whose foundation is really breaking free from a monarchy. So that said, I think that there's some potential that folks in states like Kansas who find appeal in Trump that somehow his message of the so-called anti-establishment message that he puts forth, even though he's certainly among the richest and most privileged, and that's an irony that's been discussed at length. I think that somehow that message of his is getting conflated, perhaps for some people, with their very real and understandable and deserved distrust of government and party that they feel like kind of threw them under the bus with policies.
Sarah, we hear a lot of Tom Frank's line in What's the Matter with Kansas, that people have learned to vote against their interests. In The Guardian, you say they are not idiots and they're not dangerous either, exactly. Explain.
Yeah, so I think that I'm sure this wasn't Thomas Frank's intention, but unfortunately, I think that line about people voting against their own interests and the sort of incredulousness that's met with is too often peddled as a sort of precursor to the idea that, and therefore, they're unfit to vote for, as you say, for being kind of inherently dangerous if you vote against your own best interest, you must either be mentally unfit or otherwise problematic as a member of a democracy. And so I push back against that in that, first of all, that's an incredibly undemocratic idea. There, I've seen in political discourse this year arguments in reputable publications for knowledge tests in order to qualify to cast a vote. And that, of course, was a tactic used in the Jim Crow South to keep Black Americans from voting. So I just find it astonishing that we're at that place in a political discussion this year. And one more point I'd make about the voting against one's own best interest. I might pass that judgment in my own house. I would encourage the country to not embrace that idea as a critique of an open democracy and freedom to vote. But I also want to say that it also implies a kind of gives a pass to people who are casting votes that might be for dangerous candidates, and as I believe Trump to be. So I'm here to say I'm a native of the white working class. The white working class is overwhelmingly sensible. The numbers say that they are not disproportionately voting for Trump. The narrative has fixated on them. The ones who are voting for him, just like members of the middle and upper classes who are, they are capable of voting, and I think they should own their vote. And I'm not making excuses for anybody based on their financial hardship.
I want to ask Nico Mealy, what are those sane, sensible, self-reliant, good people voting for in the Trump column, Nico?
Well, I'm a little listening to you. I was thinking of Mark Twain: "Love the country always, trust the government when it deserves it." And I think there is a sense that when Trump's two most effective lines are the system is rigged And Hillary, you've been in here 30 years, and how come you've changed nothing? And those are powerful lines. Now, the trick is, of course, it's more complicated than that. And government actually has done a lot of good things for a lot of people. And in many ways, it's really not broken. But a lot of the pieces of our social experience have broken down so that it's hard for us to experience government as successful and useful.
Let me introduce Matt Taibbi. For most of a decade now, he's at Rolling Stone magazine. He's been the chronicler, in a way, the muse of Occupy populism against Wall Street. The story of 2016, he writes now, was founded on the feeling, both right and left, of betrayal by the moneyed political class. Donald Trump feasted on that anger and then ended up making it look foolish. In a piece titled "The Fury and Failure of Donald Trump," Taibbi writes that the Republican nominee is about to be exiled after the example of Napoleon Bonaparte, France's fallen emperor in 1815. But in the Trump version of Napoleon's beach on the island of St. Helena, Matt Taibbi says Donald is going to be smoldering at Mar-a-Lago and he'll be haunting us still.
That's what I really worry about with this campaign. Obviously, the primary worry is if Trump wins, which would be the worst case scenario, because for a thousand reasons that we don't need to enumerate. But even if he loses, the problem is that the people who are going to remain in power going forward are going to be able to use Trump as an argument against almost any criticism. If people are upset, if they have complaints about their leaders, the automatic response is, oh, what, do you want to help the Trumpites? Would you rather have Donald Trump in power?
Right.
And it's just like the Bonaparte situation. Look, if you stir up that revolutionary sensibility among the people, he's there waiting to be released and waiting to wreak vengeance upon all of us. And that is a very serious concern, that he is going to act almost as this kind of permanent warning to anybody who might have a dissenting view of things.
It's mind-boggling to think that the campaign year turns out to have been something of a shell game. What fired the rebellions right and left was the sense of a neoliberal Wall Street empire run amok, and it's going to win this election on your scenario.
Yeah, it's not only going to win, but it's going to have completely crushed its primary opposition. Well, I guess it wouldn't be opposition because, the Republicans are never really opposed to the neoliberal agenda. But it's going to be seriously strengthened going forward. Whereas if you thought about it even a year ago, you would have said that things did not look so good for that kind of Wall Street-funded neoliberal 1% funded politics. Mm. There were rebellions brewing on both sides, and now you're going to see this whole class of thinkers and pundits and intellectuals who are going to say, look, we need to just stick with this, because the alternative is so horrible. And
right.
It's hard to argue with that logic, too. So it's kind of a maddening thing.
And the establishment's going to say, calm down, calm down. We had an election and she won.
Right. Which will be true, and even people who are the bitterest critics of Hillary Clinton and the status quo and this sort of neoliberal globalist economics, they're going to talk themselves into it and say, look, even that is better than the possibility of this, fascist uprising, which is a real threat now, So it almost couldn't have worked out better in some ways for that kind of politics.
Matt, I like the way you began talking about the country. It's angry, it's divided, it's insecure in some deep way. I call it a Roosevelt moment without our Roosevelt. What is the pressure, if any, on Hillary Clinton as president to become a Roosevelt, a traitor to her class, as Roosevelt himself said?
Yeah, there's enormous pressure, but I just don't see it happening with Hillary Clinton. Absent something like a military conflict which forces us all to cooperate with each other, we're in a state of almost total antipathy with each other. It's very nearing a civil war. I think it would be very hard for Hillary Clinton to have any kind of influence with the people that she's termed deplorables. They hate her with the heat of a thousand suns. I mean, if you go to any of these rallies, the passion and the anger and the disgust is at a level that is just really hard to understand. And I just don't see her finding any way to reach those people. Her obstacles are even greater than Barack Obama's, and his were pretty significant. So it's going to be tough.
Matt Taibbi, you became famous for your description of Goldman Sachs, the investment bank, as a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. What does the money power take out of this election after they realize, of course, they won?
Oh, I think they're going to be tremendously emboldened after this election because they really dodged the bullet. They were the target of invective on both sides during the primary season, but that's pretty much vanished during the general election season. And Donald Trump is now the enemy in popular society, particularly among the left, and he sort of symbolizes the evil rich guy now, and Lloyd Blankfein doesn't. You know, the really interesting thing about the WikiLeaks dump that showed the transcripts of the speeches that Hillary Clinton gave to companies like Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs was the ease with which she communicated with those kinds of people compared to the kind of stilted, parsed way that she talks in public. She was so relaxed with those people, and what you get from those speeches is that they are on the inside. They're the people who really do make the decisions in this country, or at least they're in that group, whereas, you know, actual people and actual voters are on the outside. And that's an important thing. That's a pretty damning little clue as to the way things really work in this country. But we're not really thinking about that now, because what we're thinking about instead is how awful Donald Trump is and how great it's going to be to keep him out of office. So they've dodged the bullet. They're not going to be at the center of too many controversies for a while, as long as there isn't another crash.
That was Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi, as in TV's Mike Taibbi and all the Boston Taibbis. Sarah Marsh, what, in your view, is a President Hillary Clinton going to do for real Kansans, including your grandmother and those Trump voters as well?
Well, for one thing, I mean, I think that she's at her heart a centrist, and that really is Kansas's ultimate tradition. We happen to be in a very far right swing in terms of the current state administration. But I think that, you know, in terms of policy levels, for what her actions will end up really resonating with the kind of political stripes of most Kansans. In terms of, in a broader way, why she's clearly the preferable candidate is in terms of character that speaks to Kansas, I think is kind of self-explanatory. My grandma doesn't care for Trump's ideas politically or policy-wise, but even before that, you know, for just a quiet Midwestern Catholic, there's no one is more abhorrent than Donald Trump. So I think that for, most likely Kansas will go for Trump, but overall Clinton will serve the state.
I'm wondering what they want more deeply in terms of healing or turning the page or some sort of, there's a word, forgiveness, out there that people want. What is it?
Well, I think the first thing, Kansans are aware of themselves as having been caricatured in the national media as somehow equal to or behind Trump's rise. And for those who aren't, there's a real resentment there that is under-discussed versus the economic bitterness that is discussed so often on the other side. So I think for both sides need a kind of reconciliation in different form. But what I would say is, you've had two guests now use the term civil war, which I think is incredible and preposterous. Kansas is being seen as the and let's say West Virginia, these red states or overwhelmingly largely white working class states are, you know, they're looked at as these kind of hotbeds of Trump. And your first guest, I think it was Ron Suskind, said it's the civil war is the coast versus the inland. If there's a civil war at foot, it's just as much with the 45% of All votes in the Republican primaries in metro counties in this country were for Trump, and it was like 48% in rural counties.
Stand by. I want to give Nico a bite here. Do you buy Matt Taibbi's notion that the money power has won this campaign and that Hillary is its prisoner?
Not entirely. Listening to him just then, he gives all the power to Washington, D.C. And the reality is that we live in a federation of states and we have our own communities and our own city councils and our own state legislatures and
our own street corners.
The danger in America is believing that the president has any actual power. That really the future of the republic and the democracy is in our own neighborhoods. It's in what we do in our communities. And to continue to play into this idea that that it's all in Washington, D.C., and they have the power to decide if the country goes down the tubes or not is dangerous and a terrible idea. And I urge for the sake of the republic that we resist that notion.
Fair enough, but I also the money power extends to college campuses, ambitions, the culture, the conversation, the media, and that's part of its
only
power
if
too.
We
even
let
in,
it. Only
well,
if we
that's
let
fair
it.
Enough.
Like,
good point.
Like the proliferation of smartphones gives us one vehicle to disrupt it.
I want to say farewell and thank you to Sarah Smarsh in Austin, Texas.
Thank you.
Coming up, fresh conversations about race, gender, and class. That took firm root in the cracks in this presidential race. This is Open Source. Say what you will about the evasions, the vulgarity, the personal pettiness, maybe the emptiness of the candidate soundtrack. You could still argue that 2016 was a rich year for real talk, activism, alliance making around race, around white supremacy, gender injustice, the forever war, around socialism of all things. There are buds of another public conversation coming, no matter who takes public office. So where is it headed? Sarah Leonard joins us, senior editor at The Nation magazine. She writes, at the intersection, keyword, of feminism and economics. The Nation, Sarah, and Dissent are venerable older voices of a new stirring on the left. Jacobin magazine is another, N+1, The New Inquiry, Sarah Jaffe's book on her travels this year. Where's it going?
Such a good question. I think that, and thank you for having me. I've been loving listening to the show. Well, it's important to remember that all of this activity on the left started well before this election. It wasn't some invention of the Bernie Sanders campaign. In a way, it started with Occupy and carried through Black Lives Matter. And all of these forces have managed to use the election as a platform from which to get their message out. Black Lives Matter, for example, crashed a couple of Bernie speeches and got a lot of attention for their message in a way that they wouldn't have if there were not a campaign to intervene in. So I think what this campaign has offered is momentum, and coming out of the campaign, I don't think that momentum is going to go away because it was there before we started. What I do think we'll have if Hillary Clinton gets elected is a candidate who people are very eager to push to the left. You know, we saw this in the Democratic primary. On things like policing, obviously, but also on things that she has promised, like child care, and on things she has promised not to do, like the TPP. And I think people are primed and ready to push her. I honestly think people have just been warming up.
Is she a more catalytic stimulus to organization on the left than Donald Trump might be?
Yes, and here's why. So if Hillary Clinton is elected, we know we're looking at a fairly centrist Democrat who needs people on the left in order to get elected and therefore can be pushed and has already been pushed by the fact of the Sanders campaign and all of these social movements. What this will lead to is a lot of campaigning on the left, getting ourselves together to move certain issues. If Donald Trump is elected, we are all going to be struggling just to prevent the very worst things from happening. And so instead of figuring out, well, what does a childcare plan look like that would actually benefit most Americans, we'll be thinking, well, I shudder to think, honestly, but, you know, how do we prevent mass deportations on the scale that Trump has promised? How do we deal with the fact that he doesn't think Muslims should come into America? We don't really know what he would do, but we know that we would be on our back foot instead of preparing to push him on issues that we care about, because he doesn't need to hear from us. He doesn't need our votes if he wins. He doesn't care what people on the left think. And he's going to cause a sort of chaos like we've seen during this election that will keep us sort of scrambling. And I think it's pretty clear that while a Clinton presidency is not what's desired necessarily by all these social movements, it would be much better for their goals to be able to push her instead of grappling with him.
Although I think that with if we end up with a Republican House and a Republican Senate, she's remarkably constrained. I mean, you had John McCain say last week that there will be no Supreme Court nominees if the Republicans hold the Senate. I mean, the mood in the country across the electorate is hardened into their corners, and that gives Hillary Clinton a lot less maneuvering room.
I totally agree with that. I do think that that is a different problem than having Trump in there sort of causing chaos. One of the things we saw under Obama was that he was quite constrained as well. You know, we've seen an absolutely deadlocked Congress. It's been sort of painful to watch. But that didn't prevent people from doing a tremendous amount of organizing work, some of which was designed to push him, much of which was designed to build broader movements. And we benefited from the fact that we had expectations of the government to do something useful. And when those expectations were not met, people were quite upset. I don't think that would be the same under Trump.
Got to introduce Vanessa Williamson. She co-wrote one of the best books on the rise of the Tea Party and the remaking of Republican conservatism. Welcome back, Vanessa. What is the Trump effect on that grand old party?
Well, I think what we have is a party that's really in crisis. And while that's, you know, I'm sure problematic for Republicans, I think it also leaves Democrats in a difficult spot. I mean, I certainly agree that a Clinton presidency is better for the left than a Trump presidency. But I also think that, you know, what you saw with the Bernie Sanders campaign was a real opening for a much wider array of views on the left to be to sort of move into the public sphere, and not just class issues, but race issues. And under a Clinton presidency, whether that will continue or not, I think it's really up for debate.
Well, to what extent do you think that Trump's candidacy itself is a reaction to President Obama?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Tea Party movement, in kind of a similar way, I think what you're seeing with the Trump phenomenon was pegged as some sort of economic movement, you know, about economic issues. And fundamentally, it really wasn't. It was a movement of older white conservatives who, by the way, you know, were middle class, were doing better than average Americans on average, who were very concerned to see the election of an African-American president, a president who they saw as foreign, a president who got elected with the help of young people. And they saw that as evidence that the country had changed. And I think a lot of people saw it that way. They just saw it in a threatening way.
Vanessa and Sarah and Nico, I want to introduce another thought. I've said it before, the country doesn't need a new president so much as it needs a new conversation. And strange to tell, we're getting one around race, for example, around in the Ta-Nehisi Coates era, around the persistent pattern of slavery, the habit of racial exclusion alive and well in this country today. There's this new movie from Netflix I saw this week, 13th, from Ana DuVernay. Bryan Stevenson at the center of it, but at the center of the struggle to rethink lynching, rethink the history we never ended. But that's just the start. I mean, there's gender, explosion of feeling, Michelle Obama most notably and emotionally capturing the feeling of millions and millions of women. Bernie Sanders socialism, suddenly we can talk about it. We can critique capitalism with
a... You can imagine a left.
Yes, and through it all, all the nonsense about who lost Mosul and who will get it back, a kind of dawning realization of the complete folly of military adventure in the Middle East and the disastrous consequence. How do these things come together and sort of take charge? Starting with you, Nico.
Well, I think that the public has been starved for any real political imagination.
Thank you.
For any real discussion of who we are as the American people and where we're going. You know, there is an emerging new America, right? Just as in after World War II, we had the civil rights movement. We had a generation of immigrants, Italians, Jews, and Irish, kind of rising to the highest offices in the land in the private and public sector. You know, last year was the first academic year that white children were a minority in U.S. schools. And we're kind of on the cusp of a completely new vision for America. And part of Barack Obama's presidency was the harbinger of that, and part of what we're seeing with Donald Trump's a reaction to it. But it needs new metaphors. It needs new language, new ways of thinking, and it needs, most importantly, new policies and new ways, new politics.
Doesn't it need new big vehicles of this conversation, you know, more together than the internet?
I would say it needs more small pieces loosely joined, to use David Weinberger's phrase.
Describing the internet, indeed.
Right, that we need more conversations in our local communities. There is nothing to be gained from a national conversation on cable television. It's not there for us.
Sarah Leonard.
Yes. Well, I think we're seeing a really interesting generational shift here where none of the changes that you're describing are going away, right? They're getting bigger. And so when we talk about the sort of Tea Party politics, for example, that is an inevitably shrinking coalition. And this is, it's very interesting to see how new generations are understanding themselves in these well-worn identities, whether it's gender or race. So, for example, you know, Hillary Clinton is winning by a landslide among women, but millennial women were much more skeptical of her because our experience of inequality is linked to the Wall Street crash, for example, and Hillary has ties to Wall Street. When it comes to racial politics right now, the movement for Black Lives is really different from the Black Congressional Caucus, you know, and you saw friction between older civil rights leaders and this new generation that's coming up around everything from sort of respectability politics to things like net neutrality. And so this is a really interesting developing coalition that is only going to broaden and I think is getting stronger. And I would push back a little bit against the idea that it's primarily local. Something notable about the movement for Black Lives, of course, is it has a very strong position online. And one of the most productive things the movement has done is put forward this agenda recently, sort of laying out a program for the Black Lives Matter movement. And that was done by combining groups nationally, both who have, some of them have local roots and some of them are broad and focused on issues like tech. And I think that has actually proved a very, very powerful and impressive way of pushing back on a range of regulations that actually can't be handled at the local level. You know, you can't push back against every bad prosecutor individually. We have a federal program that gives weapons to police departments. So I think you have to be looking at those different levels, and I think these movements are getting increasingly sophisticated about doing that.
I want to ask Vanessa Williamson, are there intersectional possibilities for the Tea Party? After all this, I've often thought that the Tea Party are the parents of Occupy, and they're angry, a lot of them, at the same things. What's ahead there?
I mean, I think that, you know, the other commentators have been right to say that the Tea Party is a shrinking movement. It was overwhelmingly defined by its age in addition to its conservative politics. But I think, you know, putting a lot of faith in sort of a demographic shift is really risky for several reasons. First of all, because we've seen very concerted efforts to ensure that what America looks like is not what the voting population looks like in this country. And I think that's been really, you know, there have been very powerful efforts to push back against all the efforts to remove people from the voting rolls. But at the same time, you know, those things matter. And also, I mean, at the end of the day, there are crucial issues that need to be faced immediately. You know, climate change is not an issue for 10 or 20 years from now when all these kids have grown up, you know, you were talking about earlier. And so I think that, you know, even if the sort of major issues that need to get dealt with in this country get delayed for 5 or 10 years, and, you know, as we work through the sort of demographic shift, I don't know that that's soon enough.
I want to ask Nico Mealy, before we're done, where do you go, Nico, to read, to meet, to appreciate or support the new conversation? Where are you finding, for example, it's bugged me so that the New York Times insisted, and so many commentators, dismissing the left-wing demagogue and the right-wing demagogue with the same, I don't know, complete lack of understanding either way. Where might they get together? Where would you look for it?
You know, I think it's existing in small pockets around the internet, and I don't like. I do go places like N plus one or Lenny Letter, to a lesser extent, Vox. But I think one of the problems with that is those are all pretty niche, small communities. That's not a national conversation. And what I most want, what I think the country most needs, is a local conversation, is a conversation of each of our respective communities.
Where do you go, Vanessa, and Sarah, you too, to feel that you're building something together with somebody?
I mean, I think there is a lot of reason for hope in this country. I think the conversation in this country on race is moving forward. I mean, despite Trump, honestly, I think that the conversation on gender in this country has moved forward. And, you know, in
and
some ways,
he probably prompted that. I mean, there's a certain celebration of the Trump effect on women's consciousness.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we can't pretend, I mean, I don't know who was pretending, but apparently someone was pretending this was a post-racial country. Well, that's nonsense, and we all know it now. You know, you can't pretend that there aren't gender issues that need to be dealt with directly when a candidate like Trump is one of the two major candidates. And, yeah, no, I mean, there is a way
there's
to see an upside.
There's something to having
to
it
those
in
issues
the light.
Being brought forward. Exactly.
There's something to having the ugliness in the light.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. I mean, 70% roughly of women experience harassment in the workplace, not always sexual, but all of the things that are being described in this campaign as monstrosities are to some degree just lived as part of life by most women, you know,
and
right. To pretend that this is something that only this one monstrous man is out there committing is ridiculous. And women know that. And it's a relief to have it out in the public sphere where it can be discussed. My hope is that it will not go away after the election as just some big problem that now we've dealt with. And luckily we didn't elect him, you know. Sexual harassment is not something that's done just by Republicans, you know.
I would suspect that 99.7% of Black America feels disrespect as a regular thing.
Absolutely.
Spoken, unspoken, you know, measurable or not.
I mean, I thought it was remarkable that this small thing, but that Hillary Clinton in the last debate, not the third debate, second debate, talked about implicit bias. To introduce that on a national stage as part of the conversation.
Just what did you mean?
About kind of systemic racism and the ways we don't even see our own judgments. We don't understand our own bias.
Yeah, and I think when I think about what an appealing place to be is in the next, you know, months or years in terms of seeing people coming together and trying to push these shifts in a positive direction, you know, building the bridges between these different movements is kind of where it's at. I mean, I'm a member of a labor union as a journalist. And one of the things that members of my union do together is we go out and support Black Lives Matter, intentionally building bridges between labor and the movement for Black lives. And I know if you look at, you know, BYP 100 in Chicago, for example, is really core to the movement for Black lives. They've done lots of work with the teachers in their community who have gone on strike, and they've all done work together to intervene in the criminal justice system and get rid of Anita Alvarez, who is a really vindictive, terrible prosecutor, as well as corrupt. And so I think those bridges that are starting to be built as we start to see ourselves as part of this one big picture are very inspiring and they're growing.
What's your favorite single bridge
Nico, that in your own habit?
Oh, I love to read poetry, especially poetry from young African American and Hispanic poets.
Poets
the
Unite.
New America.
Thank you, Nico Mealy, Sarah Leonard, Vanessa Williamson. Thanks also to Sarah Smarsh, Ron Susskind, and Matt Taibbi. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.